When I read Jennifer's book, and it is a wonderful book, Jennifer, and I didn't start out, I was a little worried how wonderful would it be, but I was overtaken by your honesty and a word you use, your transparency. And when you get to the end of this book, it's been a journey that I'm glad I participated in as a reader. And I know everybody else, I think, will feel the same. It's a journey. When I first started to think about this topic, I remembered being with my own children's maternal grandparents. We were on a subway platform, I think at 59th Street, and we were waiting for the number one train, waiting a long time. And next to us was a young family, and the two kids were saying, "When are we going to get to Grandpa's house? When are we going to get to Grandpa's house?" And the mother was saying, "We're going to get there. We're going to get there. You know, take it easy." And now I was thinking back to that, and what I think is grandparents, hopefully, are wonderful. Not everybody's grandparents are wonderful, but grandparents have been liberated from child raising, child care, and they can just be good to their grandchildren and buy them ice cream cones and take them to the zoo and do all the things that children love. My own children certainly had such grandparents. Jennifer obviously had more than one difficult grandparent, although it's nice to read in your book that your maternal grandmother, Ruth, she loved you and you loved her. Not all the relationships are pleasant in this book, but that seems to have been one which had warmth. Okay, enough introduction. Since most of us probably do not know the basic details of Jennifer's life, I'd like her, if you would, to tell us first, who were your grandparents? And we'll move up into the next generation.
I will explain in a minute. I first of all would like to thank all of you that you came. And I would also like to take the opportunity to say thank you to my publishing house, The Experiment, and to Carol Schneider, who is here, who is my speaker's agent, and to my dear friend Oliver, who is a childhood friend, and coming back to New York feels a bit like coming home. So, my grandparents. I have a lot of grandparents because I don't only have my biological grandparents, but I also have my adoptive grandparents. I had them all for all these years. But my biological grandparents, you probably know, at least you know my grandfather, because I guess that most of you have seen the movie Schindler's List. Is there anyone who hasn't seen the movie? No. So, yeah, one. But most, I mean, it's a movie that was seen by millions, so did I. So my grandfather is not only a movie character, but he's a real person. He was convicted after the war as a war criminal. He was extradited to Poland. He was put there on trial, and he was hanged in 1946, and actually quite close to the former concentration camp of Plaszow. My grandmother, her name is Ruth Irene, she was not convicted in the legal sense after the war, but we will talk about this later. She was also guilty.
On page 17 of your book, this is a difficult thing to say. You say your conception was a provocation. Say a little about that.
Well, I don't really represent the Aryan ideal, I would say. So this color of my skin is black, which is obviously not something that was supported by the Nazi regime. But what is more important is that I have a very different character, and therefore I choose the title of the book, My Grandfather Would Have Shot Me, which is provocative, but this is the reason why.
And let's go to your biological parents. I didn't see too much in the book about your Nigerian father. Could you say a little about who your father was and how your mother, who certainly was no stranger to racist views, how they met and how it happened that a child came out of that relationship?
I speak about my father in the book because I thought it's important to mention him, because a father is important. It's not just someone who provides some sperm, but it's someone who plays a major role in the life of a child. In my case, I didn't know my father because I was adopted at a very young age. So the only thing that I knew was his name. And my parents, they met actually in the household of my grandmother, my biological grandmother, because my grandmother, after the war, she rented out a room to a lodger. And this was a Nigerian man, and my father was a friend of this lodger. So my parents met in the household of my grandmother, and it was a relationship that was, it was a love affair. It was not an affair that was, you know, on purpose to set an example or a sign of rebellion or whatsoever. No, it was very simple. They met each other, they fell in love, and I am the result.
Do you know why your father was in Germany at the time?
Yeah, my father was a student. He came to Germany as a student and stayed there. He finished his studies. Thereafter, he went back to Nigeria for a while, and he worked there for a cultural institution. But as he said later to me, he was so annoyed by the corruption, so he went back to Germany. Today he's living in Germany. He's married to a woman, a German woman. She's a teacher, and they have more children. So I have a bunch of siblings.
And maybe just explain a little, as you understand it from your mother, why before you were 1 year old, you were put in an orphanage.
When I was 4 weeks old, my mother took me to a Catholic orphanage. So I grew up there in the care of the nuns for the first 3 years. The reason was not the color of my skin or anything like this. No, it was very simple. My mother was a single mother because she wasn't together with my father anymore. And at this very time, it wasn't as today. As a single mother, she had to earn for her own living. So she brought me to this orphanage, not because she thought this would be a solution for the rest of her life, but actually just in the beginning to have a place where I could stay. And I stayed there for 3 years, and eventually she couldn't take me back because after she separated from my father, she was in an abusive relationship. So there were some institutions involved, and it was not possible for me to go back. So I came into a foster family, and there I stayed until I was 7. And this foster family adopted me when I was 7 years old.
Tell us a little about the dynamic in the foster family. Who were the parents? Who were your siblings? How did you adapt to this life?
I was already 3 years old. So when I was in the orphanage, I was in contact with my mother and also with my biological grandmother. They visited me sporadically, or I came and visited them. So it was not that it was an adoption or coming into a foster family with having no knowledge about my past. There was a past. But I was really happy to find a place in a foster family because it meant that I could grow up in a family. And my biological family, my parents, they already had two sons, like two children themselves. So I grew up in a, one could say, really normal surrounding and a happy family. But still, there were these old ties, and I continued to see my mother, which was on the one hand nice because I missed her, but it was also difficult because when I came back, I had to go back to a family where abuse was really normal. So it was a bit, variety of feelings, I would say.
And I was struck to see that your mother would come and pick you up at the door but not enter the house, whereas your grandmother was invited in and would come in to your adoptive parents' house.
Yeah, my mother, she is She is difficult, and also our relationship was difficult. So she was less interested, I would say, in how I was living in the foster family than my grandmother. My grandmother visited regularly, and yes, she came and she asked, how am I doing? And she was very interested in how I felt as a child.
And I just want us to move a little more chronologically here. You're one of three siblings in your household now. Usually siblings are very different, and I gather you had one brother who was you were very close to and one less so. Talk a little about the two brothers.
No, it wasn't like this. I'm very close to my both brothers until today, because there were only 18 months in between the three of us. So it was we were a team, and it was not that I was closer to one than to the other. I loved them because from day one they accepted me, and they treated me like their sister.
Does that mean you had fights?
Of course we had fights. This is normal because it was a normal upbringing. But we didn't have a lot of fights. And actually, because we were three and we had two parents, we always built it, like when there were fights with the parents. So it was always the three of us against the parents. And so we were three and there were only two. So which means that sometimes we had more power than my parents, which was a good thing. Yeah, it was very normal, you know, it was a very good, normal and stable relationship that the three of us had.
And how was it in school for you, where you were clearly different physically, both in your height and your color? How were your schoolmates? How was the school experience for you?
Well, I grew up in a neighborhood in Munich. It's in Germany, a city in the south. You maybe know it because there's the famous Oktoberfest. So it was I was the only child then that had a different color. So I was I would say a bit exotic, but it was okay. I never really reflected on this myself, and only when I actually looked in the mirror, I noticed that I had a different color, and I didn't experience a lot of racism as well. So I just remember a situation when, for example, in school, the children were singing it's a nursery rhyme, and it's called The 10 Little Negroes. So this was a moment where I felt uncomfortable because I thought, I am different, and I didn't really know that I belonged to the rest of the group. But besides, no, it was never that I really felt different or uncomfortable.
That's so interesting because it had been such a brief time since extreme racism had ruled in Germany. And here you were relatively free of oppression by racism.
Yeah, there were some comments maybe when I was on the underground, but it was no. I was just lucky that I didn't experience racism on the scale as a child. And when I grew older, well, I always had the advantage that I speak fluent German, and I was also quite tall. So, and I was a woman, and yeah, then I was perceived more exotic than anything else. So this was maybe also a good protection. But there is racism in Germany. There is, yes.
If I may add my little insight based on now having met you for all of less than an hour, it would be very hard not to like you. So.
Thank you.
Some people are very hard to like, and you're the opposite. And so you went through high school, and in grade school and high school, maybe more, we Americans often wonder, I wonder, you know, how much did you learn about the Nazi period and the Holocaust in school? I hear various things. We heard nothing. We heard something. What did you learn?
I learned a lot about the Holocaust. One has to distinguish. There are different generations. Like my generation, we had to learn I think in Germany it's ninth grade. So we start and we talk about the Holocaust extensively, and it's mandatory in school. But it is different, or it was different for the second generation, and the first generation did not talk about the Holocaust at all. So, for example, my grandmother, she, after the war, she did not mention that there was such a thing as the Holocaust. And my mother, who is the second generation in school, she did not learn about the Holocaust, not a word. But we do, we do.
I would think in your grandmother's case, she had a lot of secrets there to hide in any case, so maybe she didn't want to bring up a subject which she had personal witnessing to. I mean, she did live with your grandfather overlooking the Pleskov camp, so she knew.
Yeah, that's true, but it is something more general. In the specific case of my grandmother, she did not talk about it, but it was in German society after the war, there was a wall of silence. No one talked about the Holocaust, no one. My grandmother, she, I don't know whether one could really set her as an example, because she did not talk about it in the family, but she even took on the name of my grandfather after the war. And one might assume that the thing that you wouldn't do after the war is take on the name of Amon Göt. But she took his family name because they were not married. But my grandfather promised to my grandmother that he would marry her. So it's a bit complicated. But my great-grandfather testified after the war, so she was able to take on his name. She never really tried to hide it, but she did not talk about it.
It's very disconcerting in the book to hear your grandmother speak of your grandfather, Amon Göt, as a gentleman and a wonderful person, and with all his good manners and his interest in music and culture, and so on. You know, I sort of want to scream, yeah, but you know, get off that. Tell the truth.
Yeah, absolutely. It's very disturbing. And one has to know that my grandmother had a picture of Amon Göt hanging above her bed until her death. So she was really madly in love to him or with him. And my great-grandmother says that when he was executed, overnight my grandmother went white, her hair. So I can't speak for my grandmother because I'm not in her shoes, but she must have loved him for what reason soever. For me, it was so difficult because, as I explained, I had these loving memories of my grandmother. And since she was not only one of the first people that I was attached to as a child, but she also provided me with safety, she was really a very important and strong figure in my childhood. And when I discovered the family secret, somehow to bring these two feelings that I had, the feeling of love that was there for my childhood, and the feeling of rejection when I found out that she also had this other dark side, which meant that she was capable of living outside a concentration camp with a man like Amon Göt, who was so sadistic. This was almost impossible for me in the beginning to combine these feelings. Yeah, and I think this was one of the struggles that lasted the longest for me.
I want to keep us moving here till we get to the hard stuff, shall we say. About the age of 20 or 21, you go to Paris, you work a bit as an au pair, you meet Noah, an Israeli. And I, as I understand, you were going to go to for a brief visit to Israel, and like 4.5 years later, you finally left. Tell a little about how this happened, how you were able to take root. And I have to just say, I spent 11 months in Israel working on a book. I learned to say exactly one thing in Hebrew. Ani rotza glida. I would like ice cream, please. You fluently speak Hebrew, and you got a degree, I gather, in Hebrew classes, not like Americans go and learn in English in Israel. This is just astonishing and admirable to me. So tell a little about these years in Israel.
Yes, I will go back a bit further. After I finished high school and I had this normal upbringing in Germany in the adoptive family, in Paris I met a girl that lived there for half a year as an exchange student, and her name is Noa. So we became friends, and she invited me to visit her. So I took the invitation, and I booked a flight, and I flew to Tel Aviv. And I remember when I left the plane and I was on the ground, the weather was fantastic, and I had left Munich, it was rainy and it was maybe 10 or 15 degrees. And I came to Israel and it was the sky was blue, it was bright, and it was so different than I expected that Israel would be. Because since what we learned about the Holocaust, I had the expectation that it's a country full of grief, and that the Holocaust is still, you know, something that is that the country is full of it's a dark place, actually. And also, of course, I have read the news, and I know that it's a country where there's an existing conflict between Israelis and the Palestinians. And I thought there will be bombs everywhere. So I came to the country and I found a complete different place than I expected. And I fell, the moment I was in Israel, I fell in love. I fell in love with the people. I was fascinated by the fact that you write in a different way, they have different letters, and everything was just so new to me. And then I traveled from the north to the south. I was in Jerusalem, I was up in the Golan Heights, and I came to the south, to Eilat. And there I met a guy, and it was love on first sight. So I actually decided to stay because I was in love. And I came to Israel not because I was German and I thought that I would search for forgiveness or whatsoever. It was that simple. So the relationship with this Israeli guy unfortunately didn't last, as it is when you're younger. I was very young and he was double my age. So this might have been one of the reasons. But anyhow... And but I wanted to stay in Israel anyhow, and I started to study. I studied Middle Eastern studies and African studies, and I learned the language. It's true, I speak fluent Hebrew. So I stayed instead of just a short holiday. I stayed for almost 5 years in the country. So therefore, I have a very, very special relationship to Israel, to the Jewish faith, and to the people living there.
I gather you got a job at a place called the Goethe Institute, too.
Yes, so even in this aspect tonight, coming here is for me coming home, because when I was studying, it's quite expensive, because like in the US you have to pay for your studies, and although my adoptive parents supported me, I had to earn a bit money myself, and in the beginning I worked as a waitress at the beach, but then lucky I got a job offered at the Goethe Institute, because I was there all the time. I was using the library and I just loved the place. And after a while, so they offered me a part-time job. And I worked there for 2 years, which was also interesting, because the Goethe Institute in Tel Aviv in Israel is a place where the survivors often gather, because some of the survivors, I don't know whether this term is familiar to you, but the Ashkenazim, those are the people who come from the Eastern countries, the Jews. Some of them, the language of their country is German. So a lot of survivors came to the Goethe Institute because they wanted to hear the old language that they missed. And since I had sometimes time and I worked in the library, I was reading to these survivors. I read aloud. Some of them couldn't see that well, so I was reading the newspapers aloud for them, or novels or whatsoever. So for me also, the survivors, it was never an anonymous crowd, but it were people that I met on a daily basis.
Were you subjected, if not in Germany, in Israel, to any kind of racism, given that there is this antagonism often between...
I think it's something of the past, because with all the Russians who came to Israel, that demography changed a lot. And I heard that there is a struggle between the Ashkenazim and the Sfaradim. So the Ashkenazim, actually, one says that they had it was easier for them than for the Sfaradim. Those are the people who come from countries from the Middle East, for example, as you said, Iraq. But when I came to Israel, it was also a period when the Ethiopians, the Jews from Ethiopians, entered the country. So sometimes people assume that I'm, because no one thought I'm German, obviously, because I don't look German. So some thought that I might even be a Jew from Ethiopia. Yeah, but I don't know. I heard about it, but I can't give you a straight answer on this.
May I ask what made you decide finally to leave Israel and return to Germany?
A lot of reasons. I finished with my studies. This was one of the reasons. And there was an incident when I was working at the Goethe Institute. I took the bus every morning. And one day I took the bus. I was at the bus station. And there was bus number 5, which drove to Dizengoff Center. And there was bus number 7, which went the same way. But I had to go a bit further. So I took the second bus. And I remember when I arrived at the Goethe Institute, the Goethe Institute is in the city. And it's close, actually it's next to the biggest hospital in Israel, hospital in Tel Aviv, and also next to the military station, the IDF, the Israel Defense Forces. They have a big headquarter there. And when I arrived, I came out of the bus and I heard the sirens because there was a bus attack in Tel Aviv, in the city, in Dizengoff Center. And this was actually the bus that just left before I took the bus, which took me to my office. And I understood that I could so easily lose my own life there in a country that was not my own. So this was one of the reasons why I left. And the other reason was that I suffered severe depression at this time. And I wanted to start a therapy. And I wanted to do a therapy in a country where I could speak my own language. Although I speak so many languages, still, when you talk about your personal problems, it's important that you speak in your mother tongue. So this was actually the reason.
I thought I knew all the languages that that Jennifer speaks. I just learned beforehand that Spanish is also in the mix with everything else. And this is a person who has not lived in an English-speaking country. And listen to this English. It's just, for Americans, it's it makes us very jealous, makes me jealous. Why can't I do this?
I don't have other talents. I can't play an instrument. I can't paint or draw. So everyone has his talents. Mine is obviously languages. And don't expect me to sing. My voice might be good, but I don't have a talent to sing.
We need to move along here, and you've invoked a key word here, depression, if I may say so, be not a shrink, looking at you, talking to you, seeing your smile, seeing your sense of your own comfort in yourself. Why were you depressed? And in Israel, with all the sun coming down, it wasn't the gloomy weather that you could blame depression on. What was going on? You didn't yet know. Obviously, you had difficult and complex childhood problems. Is that it? Or what was causing your depression? Did you know?
I don't know. In the beginning, I didn't even know that I suffered depression, because in the first place, I just thought I have a bad day. But I had another bad day and had another bad day. And it felt like a big dark cloud was over my head and I couldn't escape it. So it continued to feel like this. And eventually I understood that this is not a bad day or a bad period in my life, but it was a depression that I suffered. I think the reason why were, first of all, obviously the childhood experiences, because if you have a childhood like I had, and It has a lot to do with how you feel about yourself, because the first people in your life who should love you give you up. So this actually has a strong effect on your self-esteem. This was one of the reasons. But the second reason was, I guess, this toxic family secret that was hidden from me. Because although I did therapy for many years, I couldn't I still suffered depression, and it was then the period of my life later where actually everything was good. I had found a husband, not the Israeli guy, but another guy that I married. I had two children. I was successfully in my work. I worked in advertising. And still, this cloud was not... I couldn't lift the cloud.
But the family secret had not yet been revealed, and yet you had the depression prior to the revelation.
Yeah, but this is the thing that is so important to understand. It worked on a subconscious level, even though I didn't know it had an effect. And this is with family secret or with dark secret, toxic secrets, the case. Even if you don't know consciously about it, they affect you, and it can lead to depression, addiction, eating disorder, whatever, you name it. So, I couldn't... although I had the help of a therapist, I couldn't overcome this depression.
Let's go to the moment when you're in the library there in Hamburg and you come across a book, which you tell us what this book was.
Yeah, we've spoken about my childhood and about how I was brought up, so... I was almost 40 when I found the book about my mother. And one could say that this was a moment that really divided my life into a before and an after. It was an ordinary day. I had taken my kids to kindergarten. They were young then. And I was in the central library of my hometown in Hamburg. And the library is a big library. In comparison, this is a small library. The library where I found the book, it has more than 300,000 books. I was in the psychology department, not in the history department, what one might assume. And I saw a book with a red cover that grabbed my attention. And I took this book out of the shelf, and I started leafing through its pages. And in the book included, there's not only text, but there are also photographs. And there were a few photographs that the people on the photographs seemed familiar to me. And there was especially one picture, and this was a picture of a woman, and under the photograph there was a caption, and it said Ruth Irene, and it was a woman in a summer dress in the English Garden in Munich, and I know this place very well. So I continued, and I went was leafing through the book faster and faster, and in the end, I found a summarization of biographical details, and these biographical details matched perfectly the information that I had from my adoption papers. So this was the moment that I understood that this was not a random book, but that this book told the story of my biological mother.
And we're not family. Here to recount everything, because there's a book to buy for those who read it. But if you were already depressed, and you say you were, this seemed to throw you into kind of non-functionality in a way with your own children and so on. It seemed like you just couldn't function. It seemed like a really, really disastrous period for you.
Absolutely, because it was a twofold shock. The first shock was just the mere fact that there was a book existing about my biological mother that I haven't seen for so many years. And there was a book published, and I had no knowledge about this book. So this was in the library. This was actually the shock that I experienced. And I had to go out, and I was lying down on a bench outside the library, and I asked my husband, I called him, he was at his office, and I asked him if he can come and pick me up. So I went home, and at home I started to read this book, and only then I understood the content of the book. So this really, I fell into a deep depression, which lasted for a few months, and I was not able to speak to anyone. I spoke to my husband, of course, but then also to a therapist. But until I could open up, even to my adoptive parents, it took me half a year. Yeah, it was a difficult period in my life.
Again, there's much to learn in this book, and it's a very harrowing but very straight on. You're nothing if not honest in how you functioned and didn't function, and how you dealt with it and didn't deal with it. It's all there. An interesting aspect of it to me especially was how your adoptive parents dealt with the news that Amon Gert was your grandfather. Just say a few words about how they dealt with that or didn't deal with that.
When I opened up to my adoptive parents, I did so on Christmas Eve, because this is when families gather and we don't live together in the same city anymore. So Christmas Eve, everyone was at home, and I brought them the book that I have discovered about my mother and also a biography about my biological grandfather. And the reaction was, of course, they were stunned, as I was, not the same, but they were also stunned because they had no knowledge. No one told them beforehand. And so they were a bit, let's say it this way, they're academics, so they did not understand in the very beginning what this meant for me on a personal level, and they were a bit concerned whether the footnotes were right in the book. So, but with the time they understood, but we had some difficulties somehow.
It's a little maddening to see your adoptive father saying, yes, but he only killed 17 Jews in the month of June. Well, I'm exaggerating.
No, it wasn't really like this. But they have their own story. And my adoptive parents, they don't come from families where there were so famous perpetrators. But they also had to deal with the topic by themselves. And it brought up a lot of unsolved issues within themselves. And it's there's a tendency when you talk about the Holocaust that you want to close your eyes and you don't want to know more. And there was, I would say, at least in regard to my adoptive father, there was the tendency, yeah. But it was never, that he was a denier of the Holocaust. So this I want to really make clear.
Before we go to questions, I myself was very touched by the final chapter, in a way, when you agree to go to Poland, to Auschwitz, with the class of your friend's son. I think you had just lost your adoptive father. He had just died shortly before, and suddenly you're meeting a group of Israelis in the worst memory parts of Poland. Maybe just say, if you would, a few words about when you left Israel. You knew nothing about this. Now you're with these same friends. You're much older. You have a family of your own. And here you are in the evil place.
Yeah, it was such a long journey, because until I met with the group of Israeli children, I have to count, almost 2.5 years have passed by. And my friend, or one of my oldest friends that I met while I lived in Israel as a student, asked me if I could join the group. Because in Israel, it's something that almost every school offers, that they take the children back to Israel so that they can learn more about the history. And in the book, I also say, maybe in a bit provocative way, that I'm not an expert on the Holocaust. And it's not that I go there regularly and that I join school classes. But in this case, since it was such a dear friend of mine, I decided to do so. And the same day, actually, when I got on the plane to fly to Krakow, my adoptive father had died, and he suffered prostate cancer, so he was in hospital for 3 weeks, and I was there at his bedside, and it was not only that I saw someone dying, but it was the first time in my life that I experienced what death really means. And it was such an existential experience, because it also shows you how precious life is. So when I met with this group of children, I was in a very vulnerable state, and it was so wonderful to see how they with open arms they welcomed me. They didn't know that I was they didn't know that I'm the granddaughter of Amon Göt, because we decided not to tell them in advance. So I was actually introduced by my dear friend Anat when we went together to the memorial in Plaszów, and she introduced me as her friend, and she told how I came to Israel and how we met in a shared apartment, and that we have a lasting friendship for over 20 years. And then she asked me if I could say a few words to the children, and I told them who I am, or I told them about the past, who my biological grandfather is, and the kids were, they couldn't believe it, and they bombarded me with questions, and it was such a such an intense moment, or such an intense time that we spent together, because I think it was for them not only astonishing, but it was a closure, because they understood that the past does not have to repeat itself. And the kids, when they go to these places, they normally prepare poems that they write by themselves and they sing together. And they invited me to join a ceremony that they had prepared. And then there was this moment where they had a bunch of flowers of roses, and they wanted to lay the flowers there at the memorial. And they invited me then and asked me if I would like to lay down the flowers for them, which was incredible, because in the first place I thought, no, I'm not the right person to do so. But since they offered me, or they suggested that I do, I understood that I am the right person to do so. And this was an extraordinary moment, I think, for the group and also for me.
Jennifer, thank you so much. My admiration, I'm sure the admiration of all of us is just there. You're somebody pretty special. And thank you for your directness and everything. I also want to say thank you. I only learned belatedly that the English translation was sponsored by Goethe Institute. And I think that's a wonderful way for funds to be spent. Do we have questions for Jennifer?
That you either have or about to visit Israel to introduce that Hebrew edition to the public. Could you say a few words about that?
I couldn't open up to my Jewish friends for a long time, not because I was afraid that they would reject me, because I simply didn't know what this would trigger in their families. So it took me a long time until I told them about the family secret, or about the existence of my biological grandfather. It was not that I tried to hide this from them. So this is just a short explanation. But coming back to Israel, this was in February this year, the book was released, was fantastic experience, because I always wanted to have this book released in Israel. I thought this is a country where it belongs to. And I want to tell you a short story that was also included in the Haaretz article. When the book was published in Germany, some of the survivors contacted me, because they've neither seen me on TV or have heard a radio interview. And there was this one woman, she's the survivor, her name is Rina, and she contacted me already in 2013. She, or actually her daughter, because she's too old, she does not use email, but her daughter wrote me an email and asked if I'd like to meet her mother. So first we met on Skype. For the older generation, Skype is a telephone, but you can phone with each other. So we had a conversation, and this was the conversation that I will never forget in my life, because she reached out to me, and she told me that she actually met my biological grandfather in person when the Krakow ghetto was evicted. And she met him because she was a young girl, and she was suddenly standing in front of him, and he's very tall, he's 6'4" or something, like a giant for this time, and she was a small girl, and she told me that she was in front of him, and she she was hiding under her coat. She had two puppies that she had saved, two dogs. So she had these two puppies with her under the coat and was in front of my grandfather. And he wanted to know what she was hiding. And she told me that she opened up her coat and showed the two puppies to him. And they started a conversation. And she told me, she don't know why, but somehow she wasn't afraid because it was a conversation and he really wanted to know more about her. So in the moment she reacted by offering him the puppy as a present, and he took these two puppies. And what I found out later was that my grandmother had a puppy dog living with her in the household in Plaszów. And this was one of the dogs that actually belonged to the survivor Rina, with whom I had the conversation. So this is just a small circle that shows you that there are so many coincidences over the years. And meeting all these survivors, hearing their story was incredible. I also met another man who he was at one of my events that I did in Israel. And he is the son of the personal shoemaker of my grandfather, my biological grandfather. And he told me stories of his childhood that were unbelievable. Actually, he said that my grandfather was his childhood nightmare. So the time that I spent in Israel was not only interesting, but it was also in the sense of the whole journey. It was a closure. Yeah, meeting with these people, seeing how well the book was received, and that I could reach people on a very emotional level was present.
When you learned this toxic secret, your depression got worse? But then what happened? And also, that many of the Germans didn't know about what happened. They weren't told. So many people from Germany had this toxic secret too. Were they depressed? And what happened that the German people finally came clean about what happened? And how did that happen? And why?
I was a bit irritated, so I tried to give you answer that, as far as I understood it, you want to know about more about the generations, how they dealt with the Holocaust and in how far the depression actually, they overcame the depression. This was the question? Yes. I think transparency, you know, like the first generation who was involved in the war and did not talk, I don't know, they had lots of feelings of guilt, I guess. Now, at this very time, there's a trial in Germany. I don't know whether you read about it. And this is one of the last people who were actually involved in the Holocaust. He was now put on trial. He's over 90. And he says that with the course of time, he understood what happened and that he knows that what he did was wrong. But it's not... This does not count for all of the perpetrators of the first generation. I think for our generation or for the second generation, what was a healing process was that we learned more about the Holocaust, that this wall of silence was finally teared down and that we could speak about it. And today in Germany, we talk about it extensively. And as I said, for me in school, this was a subject that was so widely discussed. So I could somehow cope with it because I could get answers, I could read, you know, I could read about what was happening. But I also read, for example, most of you probably know it, the diary of Anne Frank. You know, I could see the world through Anne Frank's eyes, and all this made it easier for me to grasp. And this is true for the third generation. For the fourth generation, my children, they still deal with the Holocaust, but here we have a new phenomenon because the Holocaust is so far away, so they memorize, but they don't really understand in how far the Holocaust is connected to the today and to the future. And this is maybe also where I see myself a bit, because I think just to remember the Holocaust is not enough. It's important because there are survivors still alive, but in a few years we won't have any survivors because they are gone. So what we need to do is to have the memory of the Holocaust so that people won't say in a few years it didn't happen, but also to learn. And to learn for the future, because the elements of the Holocaust, like why people become perpetrators, this is something that this is not yet solved, this question. And we find elements like racism, anti-Semitism, or extremism. We also find it in today's societies. So it's even more important to look back and learn for the future.
Jennifer, if I could just go from the general of this lady's question to the specifics, what have you told your own children about their great-grandfather?
I told them who he was, and I told them that he's part of the family, so that it's part of their roots. But since they're young, I haven't shared all the cruel details with them. So they also haven't seen the movie Schindler's List yet. I think they're too young. And also some of the cruel details, like what my grandfather did, that he trained dogs to tear human apart. Those are facts that I think they shouldn't know. But I will, when they're older, I will answer them any question that they have. And I think that they can deal with it much better because there's a distance. And also because they don't have this connection, this on a personal level, like I had through my grandmother.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.